Social Justice Committee at ECC are working on, which we are kicking off tonight in the lobby. Stories Matter is a campaign to get diverse books in local libraries into local families while supporting discussions and community building. We are beginning to collect donations tonight to supply the local scenic regional of Washington Public Libraries with a set of diverse storybooks for young children. If you didn't check out the table and get information on your way in, please do so on your way out. Tonight, we are so thankful to be joined by this incredible panel of speakers. After I introduce them, they will each talk about their areas of expertise and their own stories, and then they will engage with you and with one another in a Q&A session. Amy Hunter has recently joined Children's Hospital in St. Louis, Missouri. As the manager of diversity and inclusion, her responsibilities include understanding and addressing health disparities, training, strategy, and integration planning for the hospital. Previously, Hunter was the director of racial justice for the YWCA of Metro St. Louis. Her role included ensuring the mission of YWCA was embedded into every internal program and department while responding to the training, presentation, and collaborative community building needs of the region. This responsibility heightened in the wake of Michael Brown's killing in Ferguson and the ensuing racial tension. Hunter's career includes corporate, nonprofit, education, and now healthcare. Her strategic lens, along with her messages of truth and transformation, are balanced with the recognition of the reality and harm of oppression and the need for organizations and communities to heal. These messages resonated far beyond the St. Louis area. Hunter has been seen on CNN, ABC, NBC, PBS, and interviewed by NPR and as a host of print media publications. She has published works and presented on issues of race and social justice throughout the United States and globally. Lucky Zip Codes, Hunter's TEDx talk, incorporates the tenets of her beliefs. While working to improve social justice, Hunter is also pursuing a PhD in education from the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Aaron Massey has committed his life to improving the lives of children growing up in low-opportunity communities. His passion and relentless commitment is deeply rooted in his upbringing in East St. Louis. Through his own journey in education, he knew that he wanted to give back and one day lead his own school in the area. Aaron earned his bachelor's degree in urban and community development in the sociology department from Illinois Wesleyan University. While at IWU, Aaron Massey was a Student Senate Executive Board Member, Black Student Union President, Alpha Kappa Delta Honor Society President, and Varsity Track and Field Captain. Massey received his master's degree in urban education policy from Brown University, where he was selected to be a Brown Executive Scholar. He started his education career in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, teaching mathematics at Prescott Middle School for Teach for America. This is where he fell in love with education. Since then, he has worked in various cities around the country, including Baton Rouge, Chicago, New Orleans, Harlem, New York, and Memphis. Now, Aaron has the honor of serving as the founding principal of an elementary school in St. Louis, Missouri. Massey believes that education is social justice and works relentlessly to ensure every scholar learns what type of leader they are, so they can continue the movement to improve their community. Christian Cohen is an artist and musician born in Indiana and raised in St. Louis. He graduated from the University of Missouri St. Louis with his bachelor's in fine arts degree. He has since been taking graduate courses in social work and has continued to make art and music with much subject matter reflecting various social issues people face every day. Christian has been involved in a number of protests and social justice actions since the murder of Mike Brown alongside other college students in a group called STL Students in Solidarity. He wishes to continue to bring awareness to social justice problems through his art and hopes that using these gifts he can inspire, empower, and encourage people to keep pushing toward creating a better society. When she was born in 1996, Kieran Williams was adopted by her loving parents who later blessed her with a sister and baby brother. She and her siblings grew up on a family farm in rural Illinois and they attended a public school in a tiny town where the population was less than 500 people. Everyone knew everyone, and personal business was never a private matter, she says. She graduated from Greenville High School in the spring of 2014 and took a gap semester. Kieran then began her higher education at Greenville College in the spring of 2015, majoring in urban and cross-cultural ministries. After completing a semester at GC, she took another gap semester to work and save some money for her next adventure, though she had no idea yet what that would be. In January of 2016, she moved to Sullivan and is continuing her college education here at East Central College, both fixing her studies around mass media communication. As a spirit who never seems to want to stay in one place for long, she's not quite sure what direction she'll be heading into next. She does know that she was born with heart for helping people, and she hopes to someday exciting set of career. Kieran says, I look forward to the many adventures that I know await me and am working hard to become the woman that I was created to be. Our moderator tonight is Amy Fry Appel. Appel is pastor at Peace Lutheran Church in Washington, Missouri, and chair of Neighbors United Ending Racism. She grew up in Alexandria, Virginia, and became passionate about justice issues at a young age, as she witnessed firsthand the disparities in opportunity between herself and her classmates of different races. After receiving her BA in anthropology from the University of Virginia, she moved to Seattle and Alaska, working seasonally and traveling in the off-season. She settled in Seattle, where she married and started her family. She graduated from Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota in 2010, and took her call at Peace that summer. She serves on her denomination's Regional Church and Society Committee, and works with the National Women and Social Justice Statement Committee. She and Peace Lutheran have recently received a grant from the Lilly Endowment to fund a sabbatical that will take her and her family to South Africa in the summer of 2017 to learn how churches there have helped to build bridges across racial and ethnic boundaries. She lives in Washington and is a librarian, and their three children, ages 14, 9, and 6. Join me in welcoming our family.
Okay, can everybody hear me?
Yes.
All right. First of all, I'd like to thank everybody for coming out tonight. I think that you all being here really shows that you care about subject matter tonight. And it does mean a lot to me to see so many people out here. As Lee said, my name is Christian Fitzgerald Coville. I'm an artist. I actually graduated last May with my Bachelor's of Fine Arts degree. I also make music. And so a lot of my subject matter has, even before everything happened in Ferguson, I've been very aware of social justice issues and obviously racism. I come from a family that is very tied to the civil rights movement. So my grandfather, his name is Reverend Albert Burns Sr., he actually marched with Dr. King back in those days. And so hearing all the stories about my grandfather and the things that he experienced on his journey with Dr. King and other pastors and preachers really inspired me when I was little. My mother is also a pastor. She grew up in Hammond, Indiana, and she told me a lot of the things that she experienced with when it comes to racism. And although I didn't experience her experiences, it hurt me to hear that my mother had to go through what she went through. For example, she won prom queen at her high school, right? This is like 1960-something. And unfortunately, the principal called her to the office and he told her, yeah, you won, congratulations, that's a great thing, but I just don't think that the city is ready for a black prom. So they actually gave it to a white student instead. She also told me about the colorism in her own family. One of my aunts is a lighter-skinned black woman, and there was a lot of favoritism. So hearing those experiences kind of already made me aware of my skin color, just from a young child. Personally, my experience with racism, I've seen officers treat my mother in a way that I've seen them not treat maybe my white friends' parents, getting just a more difficult time when she gets pulled over and things like that. And as I got older, she got more and more concerned about me, because I'm just the kind of guy, an artist, I'm a free spirit, so I do what I want to do. So I'd be out at night sometimes, just walking around, thinking, making songs in my head, rapping, and she would be mad at me because she said, you need to be home, you don't know what these officers are going to do to you. And I didn't really click at that moment, I'm like, I'm a good kid, I know I'm a good kid, I make A's and stuff in school, so I didn't have anything to worry about. When everything happened in Ferguson, it just kind of, it took things that I already knew about, things that I already, on a micro level, experienced, but it amplified it by kind of seeing the words be brought out of some people that I knew personally, and the fact that it happened down the street from where I live. I stay at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, so Ferguson really is like a 10-minute drive, if that. And I remember hearing about it on Facebook, and it was kind of like, this happens all the time. But then when I got the more details about what happened, it made me upset. And seeing videos and the way they kept trying to frame Michael Brown, the way they've done so many other young black men, really aggravated me. When the protest started, I can be honest with saying, when I heard about the Quick Trip being burned down, I was just like, man, this isn't how you go about things. You know, nobody needs to, we need to be peaceful. But I didn't have all the information. I was just going off of what people were retweeting and reposting. So one of my friends gave me a live link to the actual protest so I could watch it in real time. And what I saw really peed me off, you know what I'm saying? Like, I was watching peaceful protests, and some of which I knew personally that I saw on this live feed. And all they're doing is asking for and demanding justice, and they weren't doing anything about it. And then I see these officers who are like, it's like, you look in their eyes and it seems like they're just slaves. Like, you're not looking at people, you're looking at the enemy. And that's what I saw. They started shooting tear gas at people's yards. They started shooting tear gas at people's children outside, you know? So when I saw that, it really angered me, and it got me to the point where I just couldn't sit at home anymore and talk about this stuff and write these statuses. And yeah, I made my art, you know, trying to kind of talk about that conversation, but I'm like, I gotta be out there. I got friends out there, I got family out here. And you know, Michael Brown could have been my nephew who just went to college. I'm worried about him because of these experiences. So I got linked up with some other students from WashU, Webster, SLU, and we formulated this group called STL Students in Solidarity. So it wasn't just about, you know, police brutality, but it was just, in a broader sense, it was about injustice everywhere, not even just in America, but in other countries. But obviously, at the moment in time, it was primarily focused towards what was going on in Ferguson. So we would get together, we would meet every Saturday, and talk about what are we going to do to make a change. We're the students, we're at that age group where we got the fire, we're not going to just sit down and say, well, that's how it's always been. We felt like we wanted to do something. So we would organize protests and different actions. We actually came up with a list of demands that we wanted to see from our own universities because of the inaction that our, you know, top level, not professors, but our top level people at the university, they were silent. So with that experience, I met a lot of amazing people. Being out there, you know, being out there literally, it will change your whole perspective on things. If you watch the news, yeah, you get a little bit of the information. If you watch the live feed, yeah, you're getting more accurate information, but being out there is what changed my life. Staring officers in their eyes, looking them face to face, and just seeing some of them really, you can see the anger and the hatred behind some people. And going out there, you're kind of, you're scared, but you're like, I can't, you have to think about the future, you know, the kids, the people that you care about. And I encourage all of you to think about that as well. We don't want to sit on these panels and these discussions and just leave it as a discussion. You want to take this and figure out how can you get involved. You know, from the night of the no indictment is one thing that I really, it really impacted me, and sometimes I think it kind of gave me a little PTSD, because I was out in South City in St. Louis, okay, street was arsenal, and we were all protesting, and it's a mixed crowd, so many different people. People flew in from other countries to stand in solidarity. So there was a lot of love out there that they never showed. And I remember protesting out there, and it was always when the sun went down, the atmosphere changed. You know, they went from having officers of playing, you know, like their blue tops, and they're friendly looking, and they just had zip ties, they didn't have real handcuffs. When the sun goes down, those officers either change or they get different officers. But they weren't right here, they were ready for something bad to happen. So the night of the North, we were in Mokibis, this cafe, which is a safe space for protesters and LGBT people as well. And when we heard, McCullough say that they were not going to indict Darren Wilson, the whole room was just, we dropped with sadness. We were all hurt, you know, like, we weren't saying just convict the man, we wanted just an indictment, so can we investigate further, but no. So when that happened, we took the streets. We're protesting, nobody's breaking anything, nobody's, you know, getting violent. There's a certain point where there's a tactic that officers would use where they would break up the crowd, the protesters, where they try to get you a little smaller so they can snatch you, grab you, and arrest you. So they did that. Half of the protest crowd was white and Harrison. So I'm pretty much just stuck with maybe 10 other people who are in the STO students in solidarity. So we're linking arms and we're just protesting against the officers, and they're coming at us and they're rioting. Now these officers are supposed to give you a warning before they start to tear gas or anything at you. All I know is we're looking at the officers come towards us, and behind us, all I hear is this motor. And when we turn around, there was one of those tank vehicles they had out there, and just shooting tear gas at us. No warning, nothing. They could have ran us over. So we start running, and it feels like, I mean, it felt like we were in some type of other foreign country in war. And two girls fell, and they got trampled onto because, you know, everybody's running away. So we're running to our safe space, and they shot tear gas into Mokadis, into the place where people were fleeing. I don't know about you, but that's not ethical, in my opinion, or humane. Yeah. And that's a lot of what I experienced out protesting, feeling like I was a human. You know, I was just like this person that was being inconvenient. And, you know, to move away from the protest side of things, just people that I knew, there are some folks that the things they would say on Facebook without even lifting a finger to even maybe do more research, go out there and see it yourself. I get it. It can be dangerous, so I can understand that. But they're saying, you know, well, if you act like animals, you're going to get treated like animals. And I say, well, if you treat people like animals, then they may act a different way. I think it was the opposite. People don't just snap and go crazy for no reason. You know, you have to agitate that to happen. And that's really what I saw happen. Because there was one night, the first night that I protested, there were no officers out. And there were like maybe 800 people out just protesting. And it was peaceful as hell. No, nothing, but it was like a big parade, you know, it was love. And seeing things like that really inspired me to make more music and art to talk about these experiences. So I think, one thing I would suggest for people who are trying to figure out how can I interrupt racism, you know, especially if you are not black or a person of color, I think the first thing to do would be maybe recognize your privilege and recognize and understand that maybe there are things that you haven't experienced and you can't understand it. And it's okay that you don't understand it, but at least have the empathy to, you know, stand in solidarity with people who are going through this thing. So if you have a coworker or a friend or maybe a family member who's of color, and maybe they're feeling down today. Just imagine that we have a lot of pressure when we're hearing about another young black person getting killed unjustly, and then another no indictment, and then, you know, another Blue Lives Matter person who doesn't seem to care anything about our issues. They just say that and counter, you know, to counter Black Lives Matter. That's a lot of stuff to carry around on your shoulders when you're also just going through life. Life in general is hard, right? Day-to-day struggle. But when you got that on top of that, and then you go to work, and coworkers who probably don't even know another black person got killed today, they don't have to know. And they're having these conversations and it's going on. It's hard to engage in those conversations. When I'm thinking about that all day, I just got a new car, and I got pulled over last week because I accidentally had my high beams on. And I was like 2 minutes away from my apartment. I was just about to turn and pull me over. And I was terrified. I've never been pulled over before. You know, I never had a car before. And he called backup. I don't know why. So I got two officers behind me, and they were looking at my insurance card and everything. And it took a very long time. And I just remember I kept telling myself, keep my hands on the road, don't move in. I wanted to pick my phone up to call my mother because I was scared. I didn't know, you know, I had some issues with getting my car, so I didn't know if that was going to cause a problem with this officer. But nobody should have to feel like that, no. You know? Just because you're of a certain color and the area I was in, not that far from Ferguson, I didn't know if these officers knew my face from protesting. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of friends who have been targeted by police in plain clothes, followed, had their license plates, their information taken down, had their personal information put out because they are so vocal about these issues. It's scary. There's an activist who got killed not too long ago, about a month ago, by the name of Darren Sills. And he was a very powerful, strong black male. And he was really talking to and helping a lot of cats that are in the hood get knowledge and really see what the real issues are and stop killing each other, but see what the real issues are. He was really actually making progress with that and uniting the people. And he ended up dead, and his car shot, and then the car was set on fire. there's a lot of things about that that are very suspicious to me, because they didn't really do much of an investigation. The very next day, it wasn't roped off of police tape. There were still pieces of this car and like stuff that was in the car just out for anybody to pick up and take away. And he's made videos. Thank you. Sorry. With stuff like that, seeing people who are activists get killed possibly like that, it's terrifying. So I just encourage you all to think about the headings that a person of color may be dealing with in the chat.
All right, I'm hearing. Everybody hear me?
Yeah.
All right, cool.
I'm having a hard time hearing back there.
Now, can you hear me? Baby, saying things like, a black child doesn't belong in our family tree. On July 7th, Nelson Mandela steps down as president of South Africa, and on September 7th, Tupac is shot 4 times in a drive-by shooting. He dies 6 days later at the age of 25. The year is 2001. That little June baby is a big sister now, and it's time for her to start kindergarten. Her grandparents are totally captivated by both of their granddaughters, even though one of them has darker skin than the other. Without realizing it, she's turned whole hearts warm at just 5 years old. The little girl hasn't noticed her brown skin or her curly hair, not yet anyway. On the first day of kindergarten, she meets a little girl named Abby. Abby looks different than the rest of her classmates. Abby's skin is the shade of the delicious cookies that Grandpa sneaks her when Grandma's not looking, and her hair is poofy like thing one and thing two from her favorite story about the cat. After school, Mom is waiting for the little girl to get off the bus. She wants to know how the first day of kindergarten was. But that little June baby just has one question. Mom, why does Abby look different than us? Her mother takes her to the mirror and the little girl is astounded. She looks like Abby. The year is 2004. The little girl is a big sister once again, and this time she gets a baby brother. Her mother tells her to study hard and to speak correctly. I don't want you to sound like a black person. That was her mom's only explanation. The year is 2006. The little girl finally gets to play softball in the summer league. She's 10 now. The ball is thrown, and the umpire's call is made in favor of the June baby. A man in the crowd shouts, "You only called it like that because you two are probably sisters." That's when the little girl notices that the umpire has the same shade of skin that she does, and in her tiny town, that's very uncommon. She doesn't understand why her parents are so upset at the shouting man, but maybe someday she'll know. The year is 2010. That little June baby isn't so little more, and she's starting high school. Things are changing, her ideas, her perceptions, her body, and the world seems to be a bit more cool. The girl's hair is different than everyone else's, and in high school, different isn't good. She learns to straighten those kinky curls that frame her face to fit in with the rest of the girls. Her parents ask whether she likes black boys or white boys, and she doesn't know what the right answer is. Who is she supposed to like? The year is 2014. The little girl has just graduated high school and her family is so, so proud. She's decided to go to college, but she's not yet brave enough to leave her familiar and safe small town home. She enrolls in the local fishing university and meets people who look a lot like her for the first time. Their hair is curly and their skin is dark. She's not the only one. The girl meets a boy at school and he's not the same colored skin as she does. She falls in love with somebody who doesn't look like her family. The year is 2016. The girl has found enough courage to finally leave her parents' farm. No longer a little June baby, she enters the next chapter of her life. She enrolls at a small community college in a town closer to the dark-skinned boy that she loves. The girl gets a job waitressing at a truck stop Denny. A guest asks her if she's from the area. She tells him no. He asks what she's doing in the town. She tells him she's going to school. He tells her, "We don't like your kind here." The girl is devastated, and she realizes that the world can be even more cruel than it was in her small town back home. It breaks her heart, and eyes are finally open. The girl attends classes at the small community college, where she's exposed to the thoughts and ideas that she's been sheltered from her whole life, and things start to make a whole lot of sense. She learns about people with history that were missing from books when she was younger, and she hears stories of the people who are rendered voiceless in a country that's called free. Her voice is being born, and a fire in her soul is being kindled. That little June baby was named Kieran, which meant little one blessed one with dark skin, and that June baby is named. So I was born in 1996 and adopted by two awesome white individuals, Kevin and Lori. They loved me all so much, and I'm so blessed. But when my parents found out that they were going to get a black child to adopt, my grandpa was absolutely against it. He said, black people don't belong here, and I'm not going to call a black child my grandchild. And soon enough, I won over Grandpa's heart, and by the time he died, he was in love, and he realized that all people were the same. So growing up, I was the only dark-skinned person in my family. I didn't really recognize that, I didn't notice, I just knew that I liked playing with my family. We just had a lot of fun together. And then I started kindergarten at Southern Elementary, and it was a super small town in Southern Illinois, and I was one of two black students. Like I said in the story, I didn't notice that I was different until I saw someone else who looked different. And I knew that something was up. I couldn't figure it out. My mom finally explained, you're adopted, and that was something that opened my eyes really young. At school, the other kids didn't ever call it out. They didn't draw attention to the fact that it was different. They did always want to touch my hair, and I couldn't understand why everyone wanted to touch my curly hair. And always, people were always playing with it, and I thought that was normal, so I let it happen. My mom also really drilled it into my head that I needed to speak properly and not sound like a black person, because in her eyes that was a bad thing. So that was racism in my home that I didn't even recognize. Being 5 years old was not something to pick up on. Then I started high school at Greenville High School in Southern Illinois still. So a few more students because we merged three schools together. Whenever I started high school, I remember the basketball coach approaching me and saying, "You're black, you should be good at basketball, come out for the team." I was not athletic. I was super surprised that somebody wanted me to play sports. I played softball, I was good at that, but basketball was not my sport, and everyone was super disappointed when they found out that I was nothing like the black basketball players they saw on TV, and I just was not my thing. I also learned really quickly that curly hair was not something that was accepted in high school. Like I said, I was one of four black students in my high school, and everyone else, there was two boys and two girls, and the other girl, she's in this picture on the very far side with me, she already had straight hair, and I thought, I have to change my hair because it's cool that way, and nobody else is going to like my curly hair. So every morning I get up, it took me 4 hours to completely straighten my hair. It was really long, and it was a real pain, but that's what I had to do to be able to fit in. I started college at Greenville College. It was a little bit bigger, and I started as an urban cross-cultural ministries major. I knew that I wanted to help kids. I didn't know how. I started taking classes on different cultures, but they were all super whitewashed, and they portrayed black people as thugs and drug dealers, and they were bad people. The black people needed help, and I didn't really get that. I didn't understand why this one group of people that was the bad people, So I learned a lot of things. I also learned some things that I recognized were wrong right off the bat. I did end up to make some awesome friends who had different colors of skin like I did. I started dating a light-skinned boy, and that was different. My parents were freaked out, and like, "You can't be a black boy." And I was like, "Mom, he's just like me." And so he has been something of a lesson to my family, it's okay to look different. It's what's on the inside that counts. So then I moved here to Sullivan, and as soon as I moved, Matt ended up telling me, Sullivan's super racist, just so you know. And I didn't take that seriously at all. I'd never been approached about my skin. Nobody had ever come up to me and openly said, you know, anything to offend me. But then I got a job at Denny's at a truck stop, and there was a guest who kept looking me up and down and asked, why are you here? Where are you from? And I told him, you know, I was from Illinois, and I'm here going to school. And he looked at me with the most disgusted look on his face, and he said, we don't like your kind of here. And I remember my heart, like, I walked to the bathroom and started sobbing. I didn't know that people could be so mean, just based on how you look. And that was really hard. That was an eye-opening moment for me that broke my heart, and it started something in my soul. I got into some classes with Lee Cole, and she presented these ideas that I had never been shown before, and things that opened my eyes even more. I learned history that I didn't know existed because it wasn't in our history books. I learned that there's a lot of pain in our country, and from all of that, I have learned so many different radical ideas, and every time my parents call, I have something new to tell them. And freaks them out. They're like, what are you, 7 minutes? You're turning black. Like, what's going on? And I think that growth comes from being uncomfortable. So the fact that my parents are being uncomfortable tells me that they're growing, and that's awesome for me to see. I'm going to leave you with my favorite quote by Kendrick Lamar. And if you haven't ever listened to Kendrick Lamar, like, please do so. He speaks leaps and bounds to everything that we're talking about tonight. And says, I keep my head up high. I cross my heart and hope to die. Loving me is complicated. Too afraid. A lot of changes. I'm all right, and you're a favorite. Dark nights in my prayers. I just want to encourage all of you to interrupt racism, not by coming to a panel and sitting in and listening to someone. You need to talk and interject when you see something unjust happening, because if you don't say something, nobody's going to. This starts with all of us, and it's something that we all need to do together.
Can you all hear me?
Yeah.
Cool. Can you do me a favor? Can you, everybody raise their left hand? Raise your left hand. Okay, put that down. Can you raise your right hand now? So when we get to the question and answer session, we can use either one of those. Okay. Thank you. So I'm going to take you all through these moments of identity, and that's how I really look at a racial story, a gender story, an idea story. There are moments of your identity. I want you to do a couple moments of my own identity. So I grew up in East St. Louis. This is a post-industrialized community, and so not a lot of jobs, not a lot of opportunity necessarily, depending on family ties and stuff, not a lot, right? So the first moment of identity was just existing, just knowing, kind of seeing the world as you normally see it. As a kid growing up, I didn't see anyone outside my race. I would see it at a grocery store, maybe. We didn't talk to anyone outside of our races. And so I think that's just the standard. You know, we have our own biases as well when you grow up with one certain type of person, right? So my mom, she grew up in a rougher area in Philadelphia, and she would tell all these stories about how this white woman treated her like this, or how this white guy treated her like that. And so she brought those stories to our family. And our family would then get that information and internalize it to be, oh, okay, well, like, that's what all white people do, right? So I assumed all white people were rich when I was a kid, right? Oh, if you're white, you got some money. That's why I was told. If you're white, you're probably a racist. You know, you probably saw me as, like, less than. These are just normal things. TV obviously didn't help. And so that was like the identity that I had. That was the first moment of identity. And I think that's the moment where I first became an angry black man. Was like, oh shoot, here I am. I did nothing to no one. In fact, very few people actually know me right now, including myself. But people are treating me already in this less than way. And so that was like my pre-black man phase. like, oh, I'm angry right now. It wasn't, and so let me tell you how that materialized. So that materialized in just doing silly things. So I was suspended from school probably every 3 days from first to eighth grade. Every 3 days, it could be for something silly, maybe a fight. You know, maybe I would like curse in the middle of class. Just, I mean, I would just sit down and be like, shit. You know, whatever. I would do things because I was rebellious. I rejected any system that you can think of, right? And that's how I knew to be. It wasn't until eighth grade where I realized like that probably wasn't good because then I had to go to high school. And I went to open house at the high school that I was supposed to go to. And they were like, are you Aaron Massey? And I was like, oh yeah. And they were like, and I think that O was like, oh, you're the guy that kept on doing dumb things and you've been suspended 30 plus times. So, oh, okay. Like, I got you. I know you're doing. So we lied about my address to go to a different high school. So at that point, yeah, that's not good, I guess, but it was good for me. At that point, back then, it was like looked down upon. Yeah, you get kicked out of school. Now it's like illegal in some places. You know, but at that point, it was just like looked down upon. But I didn't see another way because I was already just still angry. I walked down the street every day looking to start a fight because I was angry. I didn't know how to express it. So when you talk about when people are protesting and then they start burning down the gas, I was out there too. It's an emotional system where it's like I don't know what to do, and so I just do. You know, and so that's where I was at. And we lied about my address, and the first thing my mom told me before I went to school, she said, Aaron, if you do the stuff that you were doing here, them white folks will lock you up. And I was like, oh, I don't want jail. And so I literally just imagined making a decision in that moment to say, hey, I'm not going to do that stuff anymore because I don't like the idea of jail. And so I made that decision. And literally the next day, I was one of two black kids in honors classes at a majority white high school where this was the first time I met and talked to a white person. I actually touched a white person. This is a new experience for me. Ryan Bingheim, the first white friend I ever had. And I literally didn't understand, you know, the thing like all white people look the same? It's not. But when I was going to high school, it felt a little bit true, and I just couldn't I didn't know. I didn't have a diverse understanding of the world, so that's what I felt. But going to the high school I went to was my very first time trying to release anger in a productive way, where it was like, all right, we can do this school stuff. Like, yeah, I see like these nerds going to school, and like, I had good grades, you know, right before I was starting to fight in seventh grade, I would like do my tests. And I, you know, punch somebody. It wasn't good, I apologize. And so now I'm one of two black kids in honors classes, but I don't live in the community. And I feel like all the black people at school knew, like, no, don't act like that, you're not from right. And then, like, all the white people were like, yeah, we never seen you before. So I got caught in the middle. So think about this, I'm in an all black community, that's where I live still. A lot of my address, I still live in the hood. But I'm one of two black kids in an all-white community. So each day, I'm right in between. I mean right in between, you know, trying to speak different languages, really. I'm right in between trying to understand certain parts of me. You know, so I go home, and I'm studying and playing, you know, trumpet in the middle of the hood. But I would go to school, and I would see guys that I knew. Like, I even knew their family members who were, like, in different groups in the community that I was in. And I would see them, and they would see me. They'll give me that look, and I'm like, I'm in school. Don't do it. I'm in school. Like, not right now. That was my life, literally every day. And I think that's where I became a little bit freer because I was allowed then, once I let go of some of that baggage, I was allowed then to explore. And so I wanted to explore everything. I joined every single club you can imagine. And not just even sports. Like, I was vice president of the French club. You know, I speak a little French, you know, but I was like, nope, I want to lead it. I was the first black lead at our high school play. I was the first black prom king at our high school. This isn't a long, I'm 28. This wasn't like a long time ago. This was like a couple years ago, y'all. And I was the first black prom king. This is an issue. So I saw it as that. But now here's another moment that's in my life. The first day of school, I'm walking down the street. Now, I don't know anything about the neighborhood. I'm just walking down the street. I have to go to the bus stop, catch the bus all the way home. And some guy drives by, and he throws a bottle at me and says, "Nigger!" And I'm like, what? I don't quite understand what just happened. And, you know, you've seen movies before. That happens in, like, movies that are set in, like, 1950. Like, those movies, like, man, if I was back then, I'd be so angry. I'd chase the car down. No, you won't. You won't. You will actually just be stuck. You know, like, if you ever just been stuck, something was so earth-shaking to you that you were just stuck. I was stuck. And I think from that moment on, I didn't want to let go of this freedom, this, like, all this newfound, like, love of exploring myself. But I got a little bit angry as a black man. I just got just a little bit more angry. And I kind of added on to that anger. So it didn't help any that by my sophomore year, my mom was diagnosed with cancer and told her she had about a month to live. So she communicated that with us. I have a twin sister and also she communicated that to us. And, I mean, as you can imagine, again, stunned. I'm like, what? Where did this come from? Like, your mom. Like, you are invincible. Nothing. Anytime I'm crying, anytime I'm mad, like, you're there. Like, your mom. You know? And then that month passed by. I'm like, okay, we're good. And then my dad dies. Just, you know, all of a sudden. Now, no health complications then. No, we wouldn't know. But just imagine this. The thing that anchors you, or at least how I grew up, the thing that anchors you is your faith in those people that have your back, that you go to them every day, and they say, hey, how was school, blah, 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 and you're really excited to tell them, and one isn't able to get out of bed, and the other one's gone. So this is another moment of identity where I'm not only just an angry black man, and now you have to think about these different intersections, right? I'm now just not only just an angry black man, but now I'm angry for a different reason, because I don't have that support system. So now, as you can imagine, I'm at a crossroads where I'm like, do I go back to the days when I was just fighting every day because I have this anger and I don't know how to communicate it, or do I just kind of keep doing what I'm doing? I hit the keep doing what I'm doing button, and I really had to ask myself, like, what would my dad want me to do? I went to school the very next day. People were looking at me like, wasn't that you? And I was like, yeah. But like, my dad would want me to do this, and I kind of locked that away, and I kept it, and I held on to it, and I hold on to it. And so, but it was a moment of identity that you have to constantly think about. And you're exactly right. When those intersections come, where you say, oh, like, these everyday struggles are real life, but then add this layer of, like, when I go outside, that person looks at me and sees a tall black guy with dread, and they're like, oh, like, I'm nervous about this guy. Like, just imagine having to consistently do that. Like that is a moment of identity where it's like, it's kind of heartbreaking that you have to deal with it. But I kind of pushed forward. I had a good base. My twin sister is a little general. She told me what to do and how to do it. And she still does. And so I had that person with me. I think my next moment of identity was going to college. Because I didn't do it for me. I did it for my mom. My mom wanted me to go to college. They never went. And I was like, all right, well, I'll go. Like, this seems cool. But, like, my 4 years of undergrad was just like, oh, okay, like, more of the same. Like, high school was real fun because it was exciting. Whether that be good or bad, it was exciting. And undergrad was just like, oh, okay, cool. Like, so more of the same. I'm going to do kind of the same thing. It wasn't until I started teaching where, like, this new identity that I actually wanted to opt into became a thing. Now I'm a teacher. Like, so now I get to make all the corny jokes, and, like, I get to do that right now. All the dancing, the whipping and that, I get to make it as tacky as possible. And that's fun to me. That's exciting to me. And I taught math, which, you know, traditionally people are like, oh, black man teach math? Like, what's that? And I'm like, yeah, we teach math. We do things. Sometimes they have to remind me, like, we do things. Like, teach math. Not taught math, but it was identity. I really wore the math teacher thing, and I put on those glasses every single day. And it was something I was very passionate about. And so I think during that time, too, I was still trying to figure out, I was like, this isn't enough. Because I'm trying to figure out the social justice piece. I have to get back home and affect the kids that growing up, exactly like me, but right now. But the hard part about that was that I didn't know anything yet. I just knew I wanted to do something. So if all you have is want, I need you to put something on paper, because want isn't enough. I need you to actually think about real plans and put them down on paper and think about them and talk about them constantly. So at this point, I'm teaching, but I'm like, oh, I need to go do stuff and learn things. And so I went to Brown. Now, this was a whole different. So now, you know, before I was in the Midwest, I'm learning things, like I got a groove, you know, I'm meeting new people. And then I went to the Northeast, where people generally hate each other, or so I thought. You know how, like, you ever just walk down the street and no one looks at you? It's just a weird thing. In the Midwest, we at least smirk, even if it's passive-aggressive. You know? Like, you know, we're like, you smirk, you're like, have you been mugging? You know, like, that smirk. But that smirk made you warm. It was like, all right, like, you know, hey, didn't mug you, you know, everything's good. In the Northeast, it was like, I have stuff to do. I don't care about who you are. Like, let's keep going, you know? And I actually grew to like that, too, because it was like, they don't care about my race. They actually just hate that I'm trying to talk to them. And, like, it was a beautiful feeling. It was like, oh, like, this is great. Like, they don't want to talk to me. I do want to talk to them because I'm from the Midwest. So I'm like, hi. And they're like, and so then I started formalizing this idea. So I had this idea every second of the day in my life of like, how do I bring something back to my neighborhood? How do I bring something back? And how do I create these moments for kids? So like that first moment where I'm in high school, besides the bottle throne, was like great. I was like, oh, Ryan, like, this is amazing. How do I create that moment for kids, but like not all the way late in high school? How do I create that moment for kids like as they continue to grow up? From there, I decided, like, look, I'm going to do this. I have to figure out a way to bring the school to my community. And I think that was, like, the next, like, moment of identity where I was like, now I'm not just a teacher, but now I'm like, all right, this is some activist stuff. Like, this, trying to create systems to change lives is activism. I don't care what brand of it is. So if you are in music, it's your brand. If you're in the food industry and like you do something to like promote the movement, you're an activist. And I had to figure out that thing. And so, you know, as a math teacher, I was just enjoying math. You know, I was just like, oh, I can be nerdy, like this is fun. But now as a person that wanted to, that had a mission, a larger mission, I just had to go forth and really think about how I'm going to impact my own community. So this is the Mike Brown stuff. But now I'm still getting tapped into this angry black man thing. Because that way it hit where it's like, oh shoot, like that's down the street. And when Mike Brown hit, I actually stopped everything that I was doing. I just came back. And I was just out there protesting. Now, the side that they don't talk about is a lot of us actually donated stuff to the local churches or because we knew they weren't gonna get any business, we knew people need support, so we donated stuff to them. So before I even went in the streets, people were actually giving food and water and such. But that next moment was interesting. And I'm sure you had the same experience. I'm in the streets, and the first thing my mom tells me is like, Aaron, don't go to jail today. And I was like, good, because I remember the last time you told me that I didn't want to go. And she told me not to go to jail, and I was like, man, like I could really go to jail today. Like it's very feasible for me to end up in jail today for simply expressing myself in a non-violent way. And one of the things that I noticed when I was protesting is, you're right, there was two sides, or at least that's how I remember, so don't take it, you know, but there were two sides of protesting going on at first. There was one side right in front of the police station where, like, you know, probably like the middle class, somewhat bougie black people, like that's what we protested. And we were like, you know, standing out there, it was like, Black Lives Matter, like we were doing that thing. But then there was this other side. And this other side was just a different type of environment where there were no police in front of the police station. None, zero. Absolutely none. But all the police in riot gear, I mean 50, with like those shields and like just a time and are ready to battle. And then you just have us. And we're just like, hold on, where are we at right now? You know, and it's just an interesting thing. And, but on TV, people saw looting. People saw, you know, guns and all these different things. But no one saw the pastors or all these people out there literally stopping violence from happening. Physically, the old guys, our generation tends to miss out on, physically moving people from stopping them from doing things. No one talked about that part. But that was a moment of identity where I'm like, all right, like, yeah, like, I'm an angry black man, but like, this is how angry I should be. But I had to, I'm about to finish up, so you're about to get it now. Like, I had to, this is the last thing, and I'm going to be quiet. I had to make a decision to either stay the course yet again as an angry black man, or just like wild out. And I decided to stay the course, and I decided that I was going to open up a school, and so that's what I'm literally right now planning and writing and opening a school, a building is secured. Kids are coming, people are slowly getting hired, and so like, I'm right now in the midst of a moment of identity where I'm like, I'm now that guy that people talk to me like, oh, hey, like, can you give me advice? I'm like, well, I'm just a boy from East St. Louis. Like, I don't know anything, but like, now I'm here. So now I'm like,
all right, I'm actually really happy that I get to go last. So I'm Amy Hunter. I just got the only black Amy you know. The black people, they totally get that. And I'm not adopted, so both my parents are black, but they were worried about me getting a job. So on the day that I was born, they had to think about how racism would impact my life. And so they gave me a name like Amy. I have a sister named Julie. Because they wanted names that could not be shortened out of respect for them and who they were and for us. And they wanted us to be called by whatever name. I think I was born an activist to pretty activist parents and grandparents on both sides. So I am fourth generation educated. My grandmother's mother had a degree on my mom's side. My grandfather's father had a degree on my dad's side. I grew up in white spaces, and so I'm very familiar with white people. And I got confused because growing up in all white space will confuse you. And in eighth grade, I went to my mom and told her that the reason why I was the only black person in honors classes was because black people don't try hard and not as smart as white people, and I was special. And so, being the next nun as she was, she sent me to a Catholic school where racism was alive and well, that I eventually kind of got kicked out. They were really cagey about a Catholic school, and they said to me, like, you don't seem like you're really happy here. Because we were protesting our principal saying black girls are here to teach the white girls how to dress, and white girls are here to teach the black girls how to think. And so me and my other white friend, Amy Hangman, had a letter writing campaign, and we blocked the stairs, there was a sit-in protest, and demanded an apology from our principal that would never give us one. But I was clear by then, my freshman year, that the reason why there were no black kids in a probably black district was because of racism. And the way that honors classes were being teased out, and the way that we were using testing and standardized testing, which had racial bias and socioeconomic bias, was all part of the system. And so I got to return back to my public school, and then I led a campaign to get more black people in AP classes and talked about our racist curriculum and all those good things. And lucky for me, I had a really good guidance counselor who went to Jackson State, and so I went to Jackson State for undergrad, where I majored in math. Because Dr. Leggett was a teacher there. Dr. Leggett was a black mathematician and statistician. And there were only three of those in the country. He was one of the professors there, and I went to my PhD in mathematics, so that led me there. One of the best parts about going to an HBCU is once you know what it's like to be free, it's impossible to tell you anything different. And so I am forever grateful for that experience. I never had to explain that I was black, because once you get there, everybody just assumes you're black. So there's no more of that proving you're black thing. Are you really black, half black, kind of black? There's none of that. You're just black, right? I'm in Mississippi, so people were like, you talk funny, which I thought was funny, right? I just owned it, like, yeah, I do. Like, yeah, from St. Louis. They're like, oh, she's from the North, right? So, but somebody took me home every weekend. I probably met the nicest, kindest people I've ever met in my entire life. I'm much nicer as a person because I've met people who take you home, who hardly knew you, who feed you all weekend long, and return you back to school in good company. And so for that, I was forever grateful. I'm the mother of four. I have twins. That's a sense of humor. I had them first. That's serious. Both of them have graduated from HBCUs now. I've got her in one and a son on his way. And so Fergus happened?
In St. Louis. I'm from St. Louis. I'm a native St. Louisan, buried from St. Louis. And I remember seeing it on my Facebook feed, my ground laying there. And kind of like you, I was like, this happens all the time. And just like went on with my day. As a matter of fact, I can tell you, when the QT was running down, I was picking my daughter up from a Miley Cyrus concert because I was telling her how misogynistic and horrible Miley Cyrus was, but she got it for her birthday present. And so she and a friend were going, and by the time I got back home, the QT burned down. And in a very shameful admission, I remember turning my head and saying, like, why would they do this? This will never end. This is just the way it is. This can't ever change. And then probably in the next second saying, what do we have to lose? And so day two, I went down to day protest in Heal for those coming to work. And really the police had blocked off the Ferguson police station almost by about 2 miles. So now I'm walking mad, stomping, because they potentially blocked off the street so you couldn't get to it. I was going to be curious, you know, I do anti-racism work for a living. I figured this might be, you know, interesting maybe. And once they blocked it off, I was just like mad. And Tracy Blackman, who's a pastor in St. Louis, asked me to speak at her church on the third day. And if I were being honest with you, like, I was really worried I was going to lose my job. I was participating in the protest. I had already been out the second night, right? And she said, we just want you to tell us what it's like to be a black mother. And so I called my son, who at the time was a senior at Howard University, and said, hey, mommy's going to share a story in front of the crowd. Like, do you mind? And he said, no, I don't mind. I'm on my way to a protest. Because of my ground here in D.C. And I said, you guys are protesting in D.C. for what's happening here? And he said to me, Mom, we're not facing this. And so I got in my car, I went in, I looked for a sign, I got a sign from Rabbi Talib, who talked about racism, and decided that I would share a story that I had not shared in 10 years, because every time I told the story, I cried. And so here's the story. So as a mom of twins, my husband and I have decided that when our twins got to be as tall as I am, I'm 5 feet tall, we would have to talk with them. And so we sat our boys down at 10, and we talked to them about what life is going to be like, that they're going to be stopped by the police, what we want them to do. This was not the time to affirm who they were and all. But in that moment, we just wanted them to come home. So they shook their heads in agreement with us that they would do so. And then at 12, my son was stopped. And so he came home to me, flustered. He was actually dropped off in a loop where we lived in the university town, and his friends were drinking. So he decided not to drink and walk home. I lived maybe a mile in the middle of the day, it was a beautiful day, and he walked home. And he saw a police officer circling, and he knew at 12 that he would be stopped. And at 12 years of age, he stopped. And so he came home flustered, trying not to cry, because he was 12 at that age, and trying not to cry. But he starts explaining to me, you know, Mom, I've got on a polo shirt. That's it. A belt. Khaki. I'm wearing very top sweaters. As if his clothing could stop it from happening. That's what he had made up in his mind. And he said, you know, I was only 5 miles away, and I knew you were home, so I thought about running home to you. And I said, don't come. Whatever you do, don't come. So yes, it was because he was black, and I said, I don't know, maybe. But it was his very last question, at 12 years old, with tears out of the bottom of his eyes, that asked. And he said, Mommy, I just want to know how long this will last. And I looked at my 12-year-old son with tears rolling down my face and said, for the rest of your life. So I went out to Ferguson the second night because I was willing to die to make that happen. What I realized is that I was waiting for my phone call, waiting for my turn. And now, interrupting racism looks like I don't get a turn. And that this ends not just for my sons, but for other sons, that black mothers are not preparing for this moment, not preparing their children to be harassed, not just by the police. And I know we spend a lot of time on the police, but every teacher that we had to go to bat for, and every classroom that we had to lobby for our kids for, to remind them of the truth about how brilliant and wonderful our children were, that schools and hospitals tear gas out of it 7 or 8 times. I've been maced. I was married to a feds. For all the people who want to cry and say, my husband's an officer, you know what, mine was too. And let me tell you a couple things about being married to law enforcement. Number one, that's the job he picked. He chose it. And it was, but the moment he doesn't want to be a federal law enforcement officer, he can just decide to do something different. The other part is that even he, with all of his fancy badge and his law degree, has his license strategically placed with his badge so that when he's pulled over, not yet, but when he's pulled over, he can show them his badge and his license at the same time. I called him when our son was about, and his first question was, did they hurt him? This is not a world that I want to remain the way that it is. And so I'm actually willing to do a whole bunch of things to interrupt it, to make it something different, to make it something better. That's what I'm deeply committed to. So in healthcare, I'm committed to ending racism where I am. When I went to the wives, I'm willing to get tear gassed. I just got back from Palestine, where it's happening there as well, and that we are paying attention to how it affects people of color globally. It's really important for like the work that we need to do. So ending colonization is something that's on my plate always, and notices are ways that we can really do impactful work. So just for the record, when I was at the White House, I started a group called Witnessing Whiteness. It's just for white people to come there. So I don't know, we've had like 500 people go through this program, it's free. You know, I didn't really think white people would pay to unlearn this, so we made it a free program. It's still free, just to do that. And it spread, so we did it here in St. Louis, but it spread to 17 other cities across the country, which was like super cool. But the white people that you see at Ferguson are all by design. So we had a plan meeting the second night. We had a conversation that white people might help protect the black people who were on the front line. And so we called the Witnessing Whiteness people, the white people who already had a clue about racism and how this worked. And that's why they were there. Some nights they were actually in front to protect the protesters that were being targeted by the police from getting into the crowd. And then they were terrified. I was still like talking to them, like, it'll be okay, they're not gonna hurt you. Not one got hurt. I think only one got arrested and the charges were dropped. So understanding how this works, and understanding that we all have a role to play is really where we're at with this. And being strategic, not just willy-nilly about it, but being really thoughtful and strategic about how we want to do this work together. And I'm the person who says, like, yeah, I think black people can get free without white people. I believe in liberation, right? Liberation comes from within. So I'm not waiting for Michelle Pfeiffer from Dangerous Minds to come and save my people. I know. Well, I'm glad I keep making movies, right? Like, they're going to come save. No. I don't believe that, right? I think liberation comes from within. But I also believe that until we are free, white people aren't free either. And we didn't create this mess on our own, and we sure as hell should have to clean it up on our own. And so I just assume everybody's on board until you show me something different. The only other thing I would say is being married to a federal law enforcement officer, we're no longer married, but being married, not because of Ferguson, but we were legally married at the time, and I got a couple of calls from a plan, and I called them, I was like, hey. So people from the KKK called, said they're going to shoot me today. I assured them that you could beat them here to me to shoot them before they shot me, but like, I just want to give you a heads up in case something happens, and could you look this person up for me in that little fancy system y'all got? So that also was really helpful, too. So I'm committed to change. You know, babies are born from needing people. We're all babies. And if we're fortunate to live one life, we need people again. The lie is the in-between. The truth is that we need each other now and all of us.
Oh, wow. I don't even know where to start. There's so much from all of you. You know. One of the things that has driven my work is, first of all, the idea that I'm a pastor, so I've got to go to the Bible, that we're called to prosper the town in which we live. Where when the people of Israel went into exile, they were told to prosper the place where they were planted and work for the best of that city. I did not ask to come to Missouri, and I'm sent here. I really didn't want to come back to the South because I didn't want to come back to places where racism was so much a part of the culture, where people would have that experience of things. I didn't want to live in the South because I didn't want that. I even said that in my last semester of seminary. Don't send me back to the South. And to me, St. Louis is the South. I know Mississippi is not, but and I guess God has a sense of humor because I got sent here in 2010 and 2014 Ferguson happened and my friend was killed. And I thought, God, why did you send me here? Why, you know, and I felt like I was called to prosper the place in which I've been planted. And to me, what that meant was what you said, liberation comes from within. I firmly believe that racism is actually a white problem. I think it's a white problem and that we have given to our black brothers and sisters to carry for us. And I think it's time for black people to step up and interrupt it and to say, this is our problem, and until we do something about it, it's holding us down in a different way, but it's holding us back from being the full people that we have been created to be. And so that's why the work that I do is so important to me. I grew up as a white person in black spaces, and so I resonated with you. You grew up as a black person in white spaces, and I saw that I was being pushed into the honors classes in my classroom, and I saw that I was in an elementary school 75% African American, and the honors classes were 75% white. And so from a very young age, I saw that privilege, and I started asking, what do I do with this? And then I went to a white college, and I tried to join the Black Student Union. And then it was crazy. And so again, trying to figure out how to use my privilege in a way that makes space for people to hear the voices of people who don't look like me. And so I'm amazed and incredibly grateful to all of you for sharing so deeply and to share your stories of pain and difficulty, and also to see the joy. I mean, I'm amazed to hear some of the joys, the creativity that comes out of your work, the identity that you have chosen. That, to me, that's an incredibly powerful statement to say, here's the identity that I grew up with, and here are the identities that I'm choosing, and to recognize the opportunities of that. I could keep going, but I'm going to see what the audience wants to hear about. Questions?
Hi, everyone.
Yes, sir.
This question goes out to everyone that is up there. You could go back to your childhood. Anytime, any moment where you had the hardest time trying to figure out who you were, what would you say to that person in the past, yourself in the past?
I think I struggled being a black child in a white family, and that was really confusing. As a little kid, and I think I would just tell myself, it's okay to be confused, and you don't have to be one person, one time, a different person, a different time. You don't have to be white when you're with your white friends, or black when you're with your black friends. Be completely you all the time, and don't be scared to be that person.
Yeah, I really, I like that answer, actually. I'd probably say something similar, you know, just, you know, the code switching, one way with certain friends and acting another way, it's like you're being torn apart sometimes. So I probably just tell myself, you know, you'll figure out who you are, but right now just be who you think you are, and you'll be okay.
I don't know. I mean, I think I wish I was afraid of the fear of rejection, right? That I talked to my name or a girl's name or whatever. I know, like, where to catch up when they're dreadful. So just, you know, I think I would do that. Like, yeah. I'd probably give myself, like, a kick at and, like, black me too. Wouldn't that be cool if my nickname was Spada and starts with me like Amy? I was like Ashley. It's like, it doesn't get any better.
Thank you, Asada. I think, what would I tell myself? You know, I don't know. I just, you're asking about the time I didn't like, I didn't know who I was.
Right.
I think the only time, I've been an angry black man for forever. Like, I still am. I'm like, it's not a bad thing. It's not dangerous. I'm just mad at the stuff that keeps happening. And so, and I'm a black man. So you put those together. But I think, I think that the time where they got confusing was sitting in my first class at Brown, and I was the only black man in there, and they asked us, what is the purpose of education? And I had to make a decision, like, hey, who am I about to be? Am I about to be this black dude and be like, it's to control people? You know? Arguably, that was my answer. Or am I going to approach it like, well, you know, it's a socialized kid? And so I think that was the time, you know, I had to really make a decision, and I would have told myself, like, Aaron, you know, and I would have said, like, listen, most of these school systems are set up to control people and, like, make them worker bees, and they really aren't trying to push you to be, like, these, like, brilliant thinkers and these artists. I'm not trying to do that. Like, I wish I would have just said that. I said some stuff like that the next day, though, so. Talk to my business. Like an infant.
sitting there. Like, the other people get on board after you've been sitting there for a while, and you go, yeah. I mean, I got bumped up. It's free, right? I didn't pay for it, right? So just noticing how sexy racism is something that I think we should be paying careful attention to. This is about dividing and conquering. You know, we said Black Lives Matter. I'm not clear why white people are so upset about this statement. Like, why don't they just say yes, they do? Like, you said, like, Asian Lives Matter. I was like, yes, they do. I mean, why is the debate, right? I mean, obviously, white lives matter, or we would have to make an definitive statement that black lives do matter. So I think the moment we'll know we're there is when, you know, people are running to end racism like we run to fall in love with each other. Like, that's the ultimate goal, right? And so we're really clear, you know, because of cognitive dissonance, like this explanation for why some black lives matter and some don't matter, and did he have a gun, didn't have a gun. I'm like, what were his grades in school, and what was his teacher like, and what was the educational system? Where's parents employed, right? I mean, I worked at a hospital that wasn't hiring any black people for almost 50 years, you know, since 50 years ago, I should say, because we were in 1919, and I can tell you, 1919, we had one black bed until 1933. And then we made a little floor section, right, for black people. So just noticing, like, it hasn't been that long. We have a long way to go, but, you know, we're not a monolithic group. So Stacey Dash is technically still a member. So, yeah, so people just have to pray for it, bless their heart, right?
Is this a question you want all of us to answer?
Do you guys feel comfortable?
I feel so comfortable. I mean, my answer is really simple. The best way to figure out if you support the Black Lives Matter movement is to ask yourself one question. And it's if you, do you believe Black Lives Matter? And, like, that's it. Like, there's no fancy way. Like, do you believe people that identify as black matter to the world and to themselves and to others? And if you say yes, then, like, you're in a movement too. Now, we do have, you know, we have people who do things that you don't like, but you gotta think about it like this. I was thinking about this when I was a kid. I'm really just didn't understand it. Listen, because of white privilege, listen, think about this. No one sitting in first class is gonna be like, you know what? Let me just check my privilege at the door and get somebody in my seat.
Yeah.
No one's gonna do that. Somebody's gonna come and make you feel uncomfortable in that seat, like, so that's the seat that you chose. Like, no one's gonna just be like, oh, let me get out of my comfy seat. Like, no, I don't want my drink, let me go sit in the back. No one's gonna do that. And so, like, people have to feel uncomfortable a little bit. Like, it's not nice, but it's true. Like, you have to feel just a little bit uncomfortable to get some things changed.
Why don't make bold people like first class?
You know? Then all lives matter. Then all lives matter. And you make all the seats the same and cool.
Divide and conquer. And it strikes me over and over again how much the Black Lives Matter movement and the Occupy movement have in common, and yet they don't seem to be working together very much. And I don't understand that, because the aims are pretty much, I mean, they're not exactly the same, but they're similar. And to me it seems like a recurrence of the division between poor whites and blacks that has happened all the way back to before, you know, to indentured servitude, you know. So I think that's just a continuation of that same trajectory. The two movements separate somehow and pit the poor white folks against the black folks so that they won't notice while all the 1%ers are taking everything from them and going to first class.
So some people have, like, in
how Black lives are portrayed in the media.
Yeah.
Is sort of what I'm trying to.
I mean, I don't expect the media to do those things. I mean, my mom was a teacher, so you know, we didn't rely on school to teach me about ABL or any at all. You know, because I was going to learn it there. All the books growing up in my house were Black people wrote the books, and you know, I mean, you know, so I don't expect the white people to do that necessarily. Although I would also say, you know, white people can demand something different. You know, since you are the majority in this country, and since you do have privilege, you know, if you feel like Black people are being stereotyped or being misrepresented in the media, say something. I mean, your voice, unfortunately, probably get heard more than mine. And probably a little further faster. So, I mean, one of the reasons why I think Ferguson is really important is because before the election of President Obama, I didn't understand why my grandparents had Martin Luther King on their wall, because I had never witnessed change. Like, I was too young. Mm-hmm. Vietnam was over, Martin Luther King and all the Kennedys had been shot, Malcolm X had been killed before I got here, right? So before the election of President Obama, I actually didn't believe that Americans could change anything. Like, I never witnessed it. Like, I heard about it, and I read about it. That's a really great idea, you know? And then when he got elected, I was like, oh, what else can we do, right? And so I think this is the time. You know, I think his election certainly had an impact on like, people thinking that life could be different and better. So I think it takes all of us to push those things like that. I mean, I didn't watch Good Times growing up, so. My parents are like, poor people are not having a good time. You're not watching that. It's not funny. It's not funny. So, I mean, but I think it takes people to protest that they see.
I think that sports are the new slavery for Black people. And I think people like Colin Kaepernick seem to be recognized for protesting and taking their platforms against the new modern form of slavery. I think that that's a big step for someone to put themselves in line of fire, knowing that people are going to be upset with him. So I really think that if that is a new form of slavery, then we have to give them big props to Colin Kaepernick for taking a stand against that.
Are you getting $1 million
right now? Right.
No.
And meanwhile, the prison industrial complex, I mean, that's really the slavery. And I mean, I think that NCAA needs to pay some players that are in college, and I think that if they were more white players and fewer African American players, that we would see some payments for the students and not expect them to just go and be grateful for their education. I think white people can stop turning off the NFL too, just because of like is there to take a stand or anything.
Let me ask you a question like this. I mean, at risk of sounding like a hotel, look that up for anybody who doesn't know what that is, which is a lot of you guys. Look it up. At risk of that sounding like a hotel, we're technically all can be seen as slaves. Like, we're all not free of something. So when you think about this idea of like, freedom, and you spoke about this a little bit, you have to really question, like, are you free? And I think about this as people talk about, like, reverse discrimination. And I think about, like, if I see a group of Black dudes walking down the street, on average, most white people will cross the street out of fear. So you're not free. If I see a group of Black dudes, I'm probably going to get a whole bunch of handshakes. You know, like, so it give me the situation. Now, I don't like a lot of different things, but, like, we're slaves in some form or fashion every single day, you know, and so, you know, I would much rather, this sounds bad, guys, it's bad, but I would much rather be a millionaire slave versus, you know, not, it sounds, if we're all going to live in fear, which that's what we're participating in right now, is living in fear, and that's the very structure of how our government was set up, let me just throw it out there, that if we're all going to live in fear, like, I want some money to do that, so then I can actually start creating different systems for other people to exist in a different way. But that's just the truth of the matter.
Yeah, kind of say what I was going to say. I feel like as far as the media goes, it's mental slavery. All of us, Black people, rapping about, and I'm not going to go anywhere. They don't know about all the other avenues that are linked to rap and the music industry. There's so many other avenues. You may not be out there, you know, like Kendrick and be the rapper himself, but you can be a producer, you can be a manager, you can be a studio coordinator. There's a lot of branches to these things. And the same goes for sports as well, but I think it's linked to slavery. They give you that one image and they tell you that's all you can be. They don't show you the other avenues that can lead you to at least be connected to the things you are passionate about. So, I mean, I think it's two sides to that coin. On the one side, you don't want black kids to only think it can only be, you know, one of four things, you know. But at the same time, if they if you're really passionate about football, maybe you're not going to be the football player, but you can definitely still be connected to football somewhere. Maybe you can be in the business somehow and just take courses that will put you in, you know, in the vicinity of your dreams. So I just don't want to, like, knock anybody's dreams down just because of the stereotypes that they set up for us. I think that you can actually take those things and live what you feel as well.
I love that phrase, being in the vicinity of your dreams. I tell my kids that.
You know, like, you go to a school and you see why are all the black kids sitting, you know, like, you see these things. So, like, I would love to change the laws, yes. However, I don't think that's where the source of things are. I think, you know, Civil Rights Act of 1964, like, it had an impact. I see that it had an impact. Nowadays, though, like, I feel like the meat of it is how people are treating each other. And how people are choosing to communicate or not communicate with each other. I honestly think that's what it is. And so when I talk about, like, the idea of, like, disrupting racism, it literally just starts with a conversation. Like, even the law starts with a conversation. Like, one conversation. And I think, like, people feel so uncomfortable to say, like, all right, well, I grew up this way. I assume white people are like this. Like, you assume some stuff about black people. Like, let's now have a conversation about how me and you are going to move forward. You know, and so, like, sure, I've changed some laws, but I want to change how people love each other. Like, in a very, and love and communicate with each other in a very real way.
I made a criminal not to educate children. I made a criminal not to employ people who want jobs. I would totally eradicate our criminal justice system, so prisons would be like a little island or something. So just so you know, like, around the world, incarceration would be different. Like, in Palestine, people had little apartments and they were walking around freely. I mean, so just, and they were there, all black people again, sorry to study with that, but they were there because they came into what is now called Israel from the Sudan and from the Eritrea. So it's against the law for them to be there, so they would go to prison for 2 years. But to see another model, still all black, but to see another model of what this could be like, I would make that, I would take the, anybody who's in there for nonviolent offense would come out of jail. The reason why people were stopping people first, anyway, and I think that's really important, like, the police department, the year before Mike Brown was killed, had gotten a 14% increase in pay. So the motivation for why they were stopping people had to do a direct tie to their compensation, so I get it, right? And so I would definitely put a cap on that. So cities could make 50% of the revenue on stops. I would change that law to be 5%. You know, so people could just drive freely. You know, if your car is a danger to somebody, that's one thing. Or if you're driving 100 in a school zone, that, you know, I could see that. But if you're driving, you know, quite honestly, because one of your taillights is uncovered, or, you know, at the end of the day, that, you know, you shouldn't go to jail for that. That fine should be equal $600 eventually. So those types of things I think should be against the law. But our entire criminal justice system is a racket. I make college free for everybody. I mean, I, you know, there are a lot of things.
Anything?
agree with you on that part. I have a lot of debt that I need to give away. I think, really, I'm not saying that changing the laws won't change anything, but the way I feel right now is like they can change the laws, but there's always like loopholes that seem to be found and ways around actually following a law that enforcement has found. So I think you would have to really change the mentality of the officers you got, because laws change all the time, right? So what's going to stop an officer from finding his own way to get away with doing something that's technically illegal? You would have to really change their minds and their hearts before you can talk about laws.
It could be illegal to kill black people. That'd be cool.
Wouldn't change.
Frontal cortex to be able to be out on the street and, I mean, just to develop mentally to be able to have a kind of older age requirement and more schooling and more education requirement.
What if it was a requirement that police officers had to like get approved by a panel of 10 people that work in the neighborhood or survey? You know, like that. It's just a simple, basic, like, hey, we want to meet the guy that's going to be like running around with a gun in our community. Like, tell us about yourself. You know, let us know, like, thinking about killing people soon. Like, I need to know. And I will ask the truth. I will ask him, like, so do you think, like, Black Lives Matter? I want to know. Like, I don't know if this guy, he just comes, and now he has a gun. So that's power, you know? Like, it's a simple.
Can I ask, because I'm not from St. Louis, and so this is something that I've wondered about, is the impact that it has had on the community to have the police officers not living in the community any longer, because they were given, at one point I think it was required that they had to live in the city of St. Louis, and then because the school systems were not living up to their requirements, they were able to move out of the city. Seems to me like living in the community with the people who they're serving would make some, you don't think that would matter?
They didn't live in the community anyway. They lived in the white part of town. Let's so at some point we have to like tell the truth, right? Like, yeah. Jesus is black when you go to Jerusalem. Let me tell you the truth. He is white when you get to the gift shop, but right where he was out of stuff, he black all day. Like, and I don't mean like black to him black, I mean like dark, right? And so, you know, we keep focusing on the police, but you know, teachers kill kids every day at school. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm in a healthcare system, and let me tell you, Pumpkin, if you're a person of color, you should stay with your loved one. You know, you should do a round the clock, have somebody be with them 24/7 until we fix healthcare, right? If you're white, you're good, just so you know. They take good care of white people. So, you know, at some point, you know, I think this conversation on racism gets really individualistic instead of systemic. And so I think laws, it's a good question, because laws really do change systems. But whether we want to admit it or not, I would have my kids moved out of the hospital had it not been the civil rights movement, right? And so like, to be like crystal clear, you know, we talk about the young people leading the movement, and really they're continuing a movement that has already been led. You know, I stand on the shoulders of other people who were here before me. It is not because I'm bright and wonderful, blah, 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 blah. No, it's because people died, right, so that I could vote, and so that I could, you know, live in the place that I live. And so I think laws are really important. And I think clarity is really important. You know, if we spend all our time talking about racist police, we're going to miss the ways in which our other institutions are playing a part of this. You know, I've spoken often about, you know, the roles that white women play. And let me be crystal clear. I actually think we could solve this issue around racism if women would work together across the racial line. Yeah. And so, I mean, I'm just saying, we are patient, we're good, we're thoughtful, we're organized, we're a whole bunch of things, right? But until we do that, we've missed it a couple of times. The suffrage movement, the ERA, this moment, right now, we're missing it. And so just to notice, you know, the way that sexism feeds is that women don't have anything to say, and the way that racism reads is that white women and black women are not connected to one another. Until I tell that mother story, and then every white mother gets the gift, because every white mother loves their kid, right? And so just noticing, like, we could make this, like, rock star kick-ass cool, but we have to decide, you know, that what we see now, which is why I like artists, is because they actually dream and see things that we've never yet seen. We have to, like, stop being so afraid. Afraid of what? White people aren't going to lose anything if we end racism. They actually, to your point, might gain a lot more. I'm not doing this because, you know, I think white people need to, like, love black people. I'm not doing it for that reason. I actually think that when you are void of love, you are missing out on the best parts of life. And if people are suffering, you can't have it whole until we end the suffering, because we are actually connected to one another. So I want my people to get it just so they know how kick-ass love is. And, you know, that last marriage didn't work out, but this new relationship is just like, awesome! And I want everybody to have that. I want everybody to have that.
Was raised in a predominantly white environment, and my white friends from high school are very white now.
Yeah, they went to black schools. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they may even date a black guy. Mm-hmm. But they're super uber white, like some of you, even Republican now. I'm just saying, like, it's not an honor.
Republican,
office,
like,
right?
The
furthest
white
it's,
people.
Yeah.
I was just trying to figure out the spectrum. Okay.
Yeah. Like, all the way, like, you were, like, with us, and now you're, yeah, there. So, I'd offer, like, we need to come up with some really good solutions as adults and people thinking about, because the kids aren't going to stay, but they're not. They're not going to stay. And they're following our models. So, I mean, at least in some ways when you had TV so you could watch people getting water hosed, now white people actually think growing up in all life is normal and natural versus contrived and because of racist policies and laws like our GI Bill and our VA loans. Like, at some point, like, we have to, like, tell the truth. Like, it's not because white people work harder that they got land, it's because it was gifted to them, because they stole it from the Native Americans who lived here. I mean, at some point, right?
Right.
Just saying. Revolutionary piece around getting free that you see, right? So if any group of oppressed people doesn't like oppression, right? But of course in our history, of course the history that we've been socialized to believe is, you know, yes, there were slave owners and then there were these underground railroad white people, right? So there's some hopefulness to white people and some spirituality I think that we get pretty early on, like to hope that white people will get it, right? Because my house is about as black. So, he's on my side. It's kind of important to think that the deity that is in blonde hair, blue eyes actually might look like you and be working with you as you were trying to get free. Just a moment to notice, like, how the socialization matters. And I think white people generally think of themselves as being individuals instead of collective groups. Until there's some privilege attached to it, then all white people want it. I use hair shampoo in the mall. I mean, in the hotel, because that's one of those privileges white people get all the time and don't think about. I would love, like, love, if every time I checked in a hotel, and I travel almost every week, if I got free hair care products, like, I think that would just be, like, rock star cool, right? And so, white people get stuff all the time for being white. It's not whether what we think. Actually, what we think about you is kind of irrelevant. It is your need to be liked or affirmed by people of color that is the way that the socialization of racism sits within your lives. So here's the difference between black and white spaces. In black space, you can do a whole bunch of stuff and never get kicked out of your family. Like, it's pretty tough. Like, I mean, like, really, really tough, right? But that's not true in white socialization, right? There's an inner-out culture. And that inner-out culture is what you're really responding to. Am I in good white people or am I out bad white people? I offer that you're all white people, you're all born good, and then something happened to you, and that something is racism, right? And so this belief that there's something inherently wrong with you or that you have to change, that's all part of the socialization. If we believe that we were actually born good, which is what I personally believe, that we're all born good, and then the socialization around it happens to us, and that happens to us piece is what keeps us not just from being fully who we are, but actualizing what we really should be, right? And how close and connected we should be and then respond in that way. If we were really connected, the moment that we all have to die because of the black people, all the white people in this audience would also be on the line with me, right? So I know how disconnected we are, because if that is the day and this is the moment, how many people stand on the line is the true test of how in or out you are. I already admitted I was going to die for it. And still am. Because I believe free is free, and this ain't free. So, and I believe it's possible.
So I believe what she just communicated was like knowledge 2.0, and I feel like a lot of people won't take that home and sit with it and really actually be able to reflect on it and chew on it in a real way. Let me answer it in a slightly different way that I'm hoping is a 1.0. There are white people like Donald Trump that exist that all black people are going to hate. No matter what, all black people are going to hate that person. There are white people that wear Make America Great Again hats that black people are going to not trust automatically because of that hat. But we know it's a fact, you're tied to Donald Trump. We don't like it. Done. Like, I can just speak for a couple people. I don't speak for a lot of people often, but when I do, it's pretty spot on. And I'm pretty sure most white people are not about to support Donald Trump. It's a big percentage. Then there are white people who have no clue of their privilege at all, and they get to operate like that for the rest of their lives. And I don't think necessarily it's the same, the hate isn't the same, but it's there where it's like, you're my everyday racism, right? You're my everyday, like, oh, you get to operate in this different world, and you don't have to actually deal with these things, and you reject these things. Like, they actually might not even be a real thing to you. And because of that, like, I don't like that you experience that, but, like, you're not a Trump if we're thinking about the spectrum, right? And so, like, I think that's what we get stuck at, is those white people sometimes feel good because they're willing to have a conversation, but not willing to point out their own biases because of the privilege that they have. And when you get in that space, that's what makes black people struggle with the day-to-day racism. And I said this when I was younger. I much rather somebody be racist to me and call me the N-word, like, so I know where they stood, versus the one that said, like, oh, yeah, my friend, and then go back into their bubble. Because I don't know how you see me. I don't know if you're, like, joking around saying N-word or blah, blah, blah. Like, at least I know not to mess with that person. At least I know I don't like them. You know, but, like, that middle ground, that gray area, privilege, but, like, don't see it and, like, speak on it a lot. Whiteness is, like, the issue that I have problems with.
If I'm honest, there's times where I'm really tired of feeling the way I feel and experiencing some of the things that I have to go through every day. And sometimes I wish I did think all white people were bad. It would make my life a little easier. Then, you know, each white person that I come in contact with, I see you're a person, but I don't know that you see me the same way. You know, my first best friend when I was 4 was white. Tripped off of that. My first best friend in elementary school and kindergarten, white, you know what I mean? And we're still close to this day. And so when I have those experiences, I'm really like, I know that not all white people are anything. And my friends, you know, my white friends, most of them are very hip to racial problems, and I really love them a lot. But then you got those moments where you do experience, like, it's funny that you brought up that Make America Great Again thing, because twice last week, we had the customer. I worked at a Whole Foods. I went over there, I saw she was a lot over there. I helped her, and then I just looked at her head, and I was like, wow. You know, I was uncomfortable. Like, it made me kind of wonder, what was she thinking about me? You know, how is she about to treat me? And sometimes, I don't know if I was reading into it too much about our interactions, but it just kind of, it kind of made me like, I kind of passed that off to my team leader. I was like, can you help this customer? I don't really know what she's asking for, and I don't want it to get all weird. So then moments like that, it makes it kind of like, again, that tearing on the inside, like, how should I feel about my people in general? I'm in a fraternity, the music fraternity, and the chapter that I, the fraternity in general is very diverse, but the chapter I'm in is predominantly white, you know, and so the night that I crossed, I mean, that's the best day ever, you finally done, you know, and we had a party, and we're all, you know, we're all brothers and brothers and everything, and my home night got shut down because one of my fraternity brothers is from Texas, and, you know, I see his humanity, so I like to say that he means well, but... Somebody was like, let's say something controversial. And the first thing he'd like to say was, nigger, right to me. I'm the only black person in this room with my brother. And that just, I didn't know what to, I felt like a deer in headlights. I didn't know how I was supposed to respond. Like, part of me was like, I should punch you in the face right now. The other part of me was like, I can't get mad because I don't want to be an angry black guy. I'm not going to think that, you know, we can't be close anymore. So moments like that make it hard for me sometimes to open up to like people that I don't know that well, or like people that I've seen in a new way, and with experiences like that. I've had other moments where I've been out with like friends or associates, and they get enough alcohol in their system, for whatever reason, they always want to talk about race and racism. And remember that one time I said nigger? Can I say nigger in a rap song? And it's like they think it's funny. They don't really, they don't feel what it feels like. What that word means, and you know, it's just sometimes for me, I wish that I did think generally like that, but I know that because we're all individuals, I can't look at all white people as, you know, one thing, but I know that all white people do operate in the same system that gives them the privilege to kind of think that those things are okay and not have to think twice about it. So, no, I don't think that all white people are bad, but I do think a lot of white people need.
I want to say again, I have always, and then speak on stage way more experience than I do. Also, I grew up with a white family and a white community. I think that being educated and knowing that white privilege is a thing, like, that would go a long way. I don't know that my parents or my brother and sister would recognize, either they don't know or they haven't been taught or they refuse to see it, that they have privilege. So I think that taking sitting down and listening to things like this helps, because if you don't know, then you're not going to be able to think about it. So that's something that I've picked up being a white girl, light-skinned, white family, you know. I just think a lot of people don't even know that white family exists.
I'm going to you think you're suffering from the white people without them being judgmental?
Her question was, do you feel that you can be yourself in front of white people without them being judgmental? Is that the question?
My answer is, if it's white people that I don't know, then no, I really don't. If it's white people that I've gotten to know and I feel like, you know, on the same wavelength, yeah, now I can talk how I talk with my black friends. Two girls right here. Thank y'all for coming out. It's important. So yeah, but initially meeting white people in Oxford, I guess sometimes depends on the age as well. I just, you know, you're right, I don't really feel like I can just be myself because I don't know how that's going to get interpreted. And I feel like there's so many negative connotations to blackness that if I talk a certain way or I got a certain look on my face, they're gonna. They already probably think something bad. That's just kind of wrong.
I think, listen. I don't give a shit. I just don't care anymore. I don't care. Like, there was a point in my life where I was like, oh, you know, I've been talking to my homeboys like, man, what I'm doing? And so, if you think, I've done it before, you know, I get it, but I'm at a point now where it's like, I'm too exhausted, like, it's too stressful. every day to wake up and be like, you know, good morning, and have the coast or something. No, I'm about to just, I can't care anymore. I don't have the energy to care anymore, because like, the more I suppress that feeling of wanting to just be myself, the angrier I get, and I have enough things to be angry about already. So I don't want to put more angry things on my plate. So this is me literally every day. I talk to funders every day, just like this. I mean, I wear a nose ring every day. You know, like, it is what it is. I had a parent come to me before, and she was like, oh, like, a principal's going to be a nose ring. I was like, oh, a principal's going to have degrees. Like, I don't care about that stuff. Like, you can see it, you can hear whatever. I'm going to literally do whatever, because, like, I am oppressed enough where it's like, I'm about to just go ahead and be me. And if that means that, like, I lose people along the way, I gain people along the way, too.
I think it depends. I try to respect who people are, but like she said, like, people are, you know, racism 101, you know. And so I make the best assumption. I mean, I'm pretty positive as a person, and so I assume everybody really wants to end racism. Like, that's me. Like, if you don't, you must not know enough. Like, so let me tell you some more, right? But I think it's like, you know, speaking Spanish when you're in Mexico, like, it's necessary in order to navigate the state that you're in. And so I believe in code switching. I believe in, you know, I don't blame white people for acting white, right? And so that's like a flaw of other people, not me, kind of quote. And so I think it probably does change. You know, there was, we just had our leaders read Whistling the Wall by Claude Steele. And I picked it, you know, there's some like really radical books, but I know my white people where I work, not ready for joy to group, right? And so I picked a book that I thought they could relate to that was written by a black scholar, because I need them to know that that's normal. Like, black people being smart is a normal thing. Like, it's not an exceptional thing. Black people are just like brilliant, off the chain, like super smart. And I need them to really know that for people who've never, and a lot of our readers have never ever read a book by a black person like ever. And so I think that's important, but I picked one that was easy enough for them to get, you know, instead of giving them something like post-traumatic slave syndrome, like they weren't ready. And then a little apartheid, they weren't ready. It is their next book, but they weren't ready in the first book, right? And so I think it's important to meet people where they are without judging their shame or blame. Like, how would they know, right? I mean, I told the story about my son, and he hit the wire, and I was like, why is this news? You know, I mean, honestly, I'm pretty humble anyway, but I was like, that's why is that? His wife is a victim. That's a lie. And so I think it's important that as much bridging as we can do, because I think people want to get it and just don't have it. I think if we have the ability to bridge, I think we should bridge.
So I've been trying to think of how to word this, but there's this one commercial where there's like the old man with like a dollar bill on his fishing pole, and he's like, and I feel like that's how it is when you hear, if you can't, you know, join, or if you don't like the system, you come. Do you feel like that's a white construction made by, you know, like, white men in upper class, like, elite individuals who are just saying, you know, you guys have to change the system, like, we're not doing anything, you know? Like, do you think that's a one-sided talk?
It's a dominant structure. It's a structure because white people are in the dominant position. But if you just look at a group of people, let's say you have five people and they have on, four of them have pink hats on, and one of them has a blue hat, right?
Yeah.
Those four people aren't going to be like, oh, nice blue hat. They don't look at them like, we got pink hats. Like, it's a dominant thing. And so that very structure, not forces, because, well, in some ways, but like it pushes people to then want to be part of that because you want to feel like you belong to something. And it's safer to be in that mainstream versus out of the mainstream. And it makes you feel better in a lot of different ways on a lot of different levels. It makes you feel better if you're accepted in those different ways. But it's a dominant culture type of thing, and white people are in the dominant culture.
I also think it's part of the scarcity.
do what you want.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, this belief that there isn't enough, right? But there are some things that there is. There are plenty of, certainly food's one of them. It's like people overweight and other people are starving, right? So there is enough food. But I think the other part is, you know, I usually say if you're over the age of 40, you're rejected. And so nobody likes to have that feeling. And so instead of us moving towards the, you know, the dollar bill that's like, oh, come this way, you know, that we think in radical ways, right? Like, there's enough love for everybody. And if we loved each other, our school systems would be different. If we loved each other, poverty would be different. Like, we wouldn't make up a stupid word that we're doing for, right? That should not be a word. And so I think part of this in-or-out culture really is part of the colonization, right? Not just of our minds, but of our systems. And so to decolonize the structure means that we can have it all, like, and the possibility. Back to my artists, and then, you know, they see stuff so different, like, great words we've never heard, beats we've never heard, art we've never seen before. Like, I think, you know, for us to interrupt racism, that's what this really, really looks like, is that we think about what we could really have instead of what we're just willing to settle for. The goal isn't to get better, the goal is to get free.
Yeah, the system is broken, so I mean, the way I look at it is we need a new system, like trying to go into something. I don't want to eat at the table with eating a bunch of shit, you know what I'm saying? Well, I don't need to have something different on the table, or a different table, you know? That's just how I feel.
Trying to put a number of things together is very complex. Relating to the notion of neighbors, one of the sponsors of the discussion this evening, and tying in your reference to America and some of the issues with America as a system, I would suggest that, or ask, do we, is it a decent analogy to say that individually with our white privilege, which we cultivate knowingly or unknowingly, are not like America and its exceptionalism and it not being a friendly neighbor or a neighbor that other countries like to have? I think as white people, just automatically, with the privilege we have, are neighbors that that other people need to be cautious about, because we don't realize how our steps damage, how our footprint damages the world we walk on, and that certainly is applicable to the environment as well as to peoples. So I relate that to the notion too then of, if we want to take some action, would you see it as a valuable suggestion that using social media for major change, as in the in a number of countries around the world where significant changes have been made because of social media, that each of us would, in our own domain of social communication, communicate more, for example, this evening's experience, and to communicate in our use of the social media a much better representation of the diversity that exists in the world and in the U.S. of A. I think I'd end with another thing that I keep mulling over, being a part of this group now, Neighbors United Undoing Racism. One of the Washington U professors wrote a book recently. He just died in the past year. The Myth of Racism. It really is a social construction. And so in a sense, by repeating it rather than just coming up with something else, diversity of a species, we are the same species. And so all of these other differences are really just aspects of the human race. But again, I would suggest, we were at the moral minority discussion when they came into town, and the recommendation was to go out with some action. And I would ask whether you would recommend that kind of action that I explained about using our social media to indeed change the system and override the media with a capital M.
But I honestly, at this point, I get so nervous with social media because any fool can say anything, just anything. I mean, and it's almost a dare. It's almost like, hey, let's say something crazy. It really is. Like, no matter what, you take a firm stance on something, and something can be very emotional, or not a firm stance. You can say, like, oh, I'm struggling right now as a black person, and then someone, you know, they say some crazy stuff. And so, yeah, I think so, but we should have, like, white ambassadors of the internet where, you know, you have a black person post, like, oh, Black Lives Matter, like, I went to this movement, I was so excited. Of course, somebody is going to say something like, oh, whatever, anywhere, of course. And I want a white person to step in and be like, that was dumb. You know, because if it came from a black person, they would think it's a racial debate. But really, it was actually just stupidity. You know, like, we have to just be able to call out stupidity, and like with social media, it's asking for the argument almost. And so, like, I really want people to, like, own that to the extent of which it will allow other people to actually say things that can be communicated in a useful way, as opposed to people just trolling all day. And some people really just troll all day.
Yeah. I think I'd just really quickly ask white people to, you know, once white people understand what racism is, and it is a social construct and very real, right, is that they first forgive themselves. Because I think part of the task is that white people think they know everything. And then we have this conversation about racism, like, how did I not know this? Why did I know this, right? And so, I mean, that's the first thing. And then the second thing would be to really work with other white people. Like, I don't need you to come and rub any more heads in the black space. You know, I don't need that. And, you know, black kids are so cute. Oh, they're not puppies, they're people, right? And so, but working with other white people to build community, so many white people have been like, the black people get together and, like, they're so cool together. Like, do you know all those people? Like, you know what? Hey, people, you could have this too. We're just saying hello to each other. We are just being kind to each other. Like, you could have the kind of community that you see or witness other communities of color having with each other. Like, remember, this is like a divide and conquer. And so just understanding the construct of whiteness was to keep you also separate. Because you came here separated, right? Only Native Americans and Native Americans. Everybody else came here to place self. And so, but white was the title that made you feel like you were connected in some shape or fashion. And really, it caused more distress. Because now you don't even know where you're from, and people, you don't have any heritage, and all that kind of stuff. So I would just say, you know, forgive yourselves and then come up with an action plan. And the action plan should be loving and being with other white people to get them close, instead of pushing them away or forming the white people pool group or whatever. You know, all white, you just be together and work with each other.
Like, and have white leaders. Like, that's, you know, like, you can have white leaders lead those things. It doesn't have to be like a black person in front of them. Like, I want, in the same vein, I want white people to then own that, like, own, like, oh, like, that is happening. I'm in a position of power to be able to address that. So let me own, like, be the white leader.
Okay. So one more question I was going to take before we, I see Lee lurking, because there's not enough time there, but I saw a camera there.
First, I agree. Thank you all for coming out. The other thing you just spoke, she's raised down here from Franklin County, and I come here originally raised more in Cornwall.
was just going to say, growing up with my family, now that I'm an educated Black woman, it freaks my parents out, my white parents out, that I would say the sentence Black Lives Matter. That in their head is like, whoa, like, she doesn't care about white people. And that's not the case. I also think that, like you said, exposing yourself to other people, traveling, I've been super blessed to be able to travel a lot. I've met a gazillion different people. I think, like you said, like, loving people is what we're called to do, you know? And love's gonna get farther than arguing. So kind of like what Aaron was saying, like, teaching kids to love each other, even if you do have to force them to love each other. I think that whenever you expose yourself to different groups of people and continue to love all the groups of people, that goes a long way.
Yeah. I just point of clarification, like, Black people can't be racist. We can be prejudiced, we can be biased, but we don't hold power to influence all the lives of white people. But they can be prejudiced, and I agree with you. I would offer a couple of things, right? So some of the scripting that Black people are receiving around race in particular are for their protection. And so just for clarification, white on white crime is 89%, Black on Black crime is 89%. In Jefferson County, you're more likely to be killed by a white person if you're white than a Black person any day of the week, right? Raped and hurt.
Right.
So right. So how the media has spun this, right, is that the only people who have crime on each other are Black people. Every racial group has crime on each other. I would offer that. I think what I'm hearing, at least from young people and definitely from my generation, is that we don't want to be like white people. We want to be okay being Black people. And so some of that sameness conversation, just in my very humble opinion, it feels like, you know, as long as we are close to white people, then that will make white people more comfortable, and the more comfortable white people are, the better this will be. And so when white people go to this place, like, we're so alike, we're so much alike. I mean, I agree. You know, we're all human beings to his point. We're all human. Except the practice of loving other people outside of your race happens in Black spaces way more often than it happens in white spaces. And some of that is for our survival. Not because we're like more loving, although I might argue we are, but actually because, you know, it is part of our socialization so that we will be okay, right? So that we'll come home. And so I just want to be like really like crystal clear, like the part about this love thing, you know, in Black people, like, I think we really understand love, and I think white people to a certain extent really do understand love of each other, but the practice of loving across the color line has not happened in a very long time, if ever, in a humane way, right? So I think there's been a kittens and puppies way that white people have loved Black people, but that's not what we're asking for. That's not what I'm asking for, at least in my eyes. I'm not asking you to love me like that cute little Black, happy Black girl, like I get pigeonholed into the whole time until I'm on protest line in Ferguson, right? I want you to love me, like, completely all the way to who I am. And the idea that you have to do something, some kind of adjustment to get there, is all of the racism that fills in your head, right? Because I go back to that, babies are born. Everybody in here can have a mental model image of who the baby is. And we love them. Like, babies come into this world and we love them. The fact that that turned into something else is racism. Right? And I don't see a whole lot of Black people saying, oh, we don't like this white baby. But I see a whole lot of white people. Before Blue Ivy was born, I don't know another historical moment where people in this country were celebrating the life and birth of a Black child ever in the United States, and they weren't going to profit off of it like chattel slavery. And so here is the moment for not just what the world looks like. We're talking about love, and, you know, bless our heart, you know, right? We're going to bring God's love into it, right? So God loves all of us, right? And so if this is the moment where God loves all of us, then that means that we get to practice not missionary work, but servant leadership. And when we're practicing servant leadership, we are serving one God and acting in service to that God. It is hard for me to believe in a city and a town where 50% of the African-American men graduate from high school that we're loving each other. And so I'm really clear there's some love missing because there's no way 50% of the white men in St. Louis could not graduate from high school and we'd be okay with that. And so I'm cool with love, but let me tell you, I will know when I'm loved and when I'm not loved. And right now, my people that I identify with are not in the loved group. And until they get there, because they're fully lovable, totally competent, so good, so brilliant, and the fact that we have to articulate that proof and overproof and every Tatum's book, Why Are They Sitting Together in Classroom, isn't about isolation. It is about the understanding that Black children are fatigued and they need time by themselves so they can rejuvenate from the racism that they face in school. There's nothing wrong with them wanting to sit with each other. Actually, it's keeping them not only whole, but keeping them sane. And so this is not about having every other, that's to appease white people. So white people don't feel like they're being racist. If you don't want to feel like you're being racist, then that 50% I just talked about will be 90% or 70% like the national average. That's when we know, when we are doing test scores and they look totally random and we're not aggregating this data by race, that's how we know we have equality. And until we get there, quite honestly, I'm not done, I'm not fine, and it's not okay. This is not the kind of piece. It's not good enough for my kids to go to college and every other African American can't go. Whether you want to go or not, you should all be prepared to go, and we're not there. We're not there, and so I'm not gonna, you know, be happy and la 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 and be in my little Jack and Jill group, which I'm a Jack and Jill, y'all talk about me later, right? And be okay with it because I care about the group of people that are oppressed, not just here, but in Palestine and around the world. And I think part of the reason why we are where we are and why Ferguson had to happen is because we've been so lulled into being okay, and as long as we were okay, it's okay, and I'm totally fine with disrupting okay. Because it isn't okay with me that some of our children don't get access to quality education, that some of our people are incarcerated in cages. It's just not okay. And so while we're thinking about how we're saying, when white men are going to jail like black men are going to jail, that's sane, and that'd be fine with me if we were all going at the same rate, but since we're not sane. And that's what I would continue to fight for. I would continue to fight for the equality of the people that are oppressed right now. And right now, it's black people, and I'm gonna stay totally focused on what that is, and we can get free.
I think what this love piece, that when people communicate it, it is this like, oh, turn the other cheek type of love. I'm just like not, I'm not interested in it. I think it goes back to what Shania was saying. Well, not necessarily what you're saying. I'm saying that by and large, when people cite like love, they throw a Martin Luther King quote on there, and they be like, you know, love, and like love relentlessly. Like, say it again.
I think being comfortable with, it's not so much that, oh, we all know love,
many things in what you just said that are like really true. And so let me say, what breaks my heart, let me start there, is that we have been in strategically and intentionally placed in positions where we have forgotten all of the things that I mentioned before, right? And so it isn't that he made a choice. The choice he made was to believe what his mother was telling him every day, because whether he was confused or not, she was never confused. And so what I see are kids that are confused with parents that have been confused, right? Because if you don't grow up in Black kids, and he was in a sweet spot, right? Because he's in his life faith with somebody who's promoting and pushing and gagging at it, right? If he didn't have all that, his life would have been different. And it wouldn't have been because he was a bad person. It would have been because the choices that he had in front of him would have been different. And so before we start blaming, you know, people for where they are, we have to understand, like, it is a system that puts the people in the position that where they were. Does that make sense? Yeah. I mean, we got a war on drugs that has mass incarceration for almost three generations of black men. It has done something to the community. We have to grieve the loss of the missing black people that we have lost, that we've watched systemically be taken in front of us, because meth and heroin are so on fleek right now, but high in the air, that the police departments now have an option to take the people who are on meth and heroin to the hospital instead of putting them in jail. And that is white privilege, right? Because when it was a crack epidemic, they all went to jail. They went to jail for a very, very long time. And so just noticing how the system of hospitals, which is one of the systems I'm in, has colluded with the system of law enforcement, right? That these systems have to work together in order for these things to happen. So our school system's working in tandem with our prison system. And so I understand the plight where black people are, but I also understand that you are using a lens and an experience that, quite honestly, we don't have. Remember what I said, like, I don't believe this could really happen until Barack Obama won? It's because you're using a set of eyes that we have not seen. And so this is going to be an important moment that the people who are over 50 have conversations with the young people about hope and blah, 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 in a way that they're not, because right now they're afraid of them, but I'm real talk, right? So they're not going into the inner cities because they're scared, right? And so I'm real talk, right? They don't know what's happening because they're not there, right? You go to Ferguson, you can see it on TV, but being there was different, right? And so, you know, it does back to that liberation thing, like, white people aren't going to say this, but the older black people could shed some wisdom on the younger black people in a way that brings hope and love and joy and all that kind of stuff. But to be raised in a place where you aren't loved, I mean, it's quite unimaginable. And then to go to a school where you're not loved is even more horrific, right? And then to be in a justice system that doesn't love you is even worse. And so we think that they're making bad choices, but really they're making systemic choices, and the system is stacked so deeply against them that it's really hard to make other decisions. It just is. And so that's why this revolution and all this blowing up stuff has to happen, because this is actually their moment of believing that it could be different. So we're not really trying to stop them. I mean, I don't care that they burn down a QT. I really don't. It's a stupid building. It was overpriced. It was in the black neighborhood on purpose. I'm not missing QT. And it raised national attention, and it made the young people think that it could change. And it can change, but it can't change with us being nice and believing that the civil rights movement was some nonviolent protest, because it wasn't. It wasn't nonviolent. It was violent as hell. Real talk. How many black people and white people do you have to sign up to get beat to go on a lunch counter to get to sit at the lunch counter, right? And then that lunch counter got us into jobs, right? But how mad do you have to be to sign up to get beat? You have to be very mad. And so the same rage that he's talking about is the same rage that's going to propel us to the next place. We just need to stop saying stop, 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 young people, and let them go, go, go. Unless you have a different idea, a different strategy, let the young people go, support the young people's work, tell the old people who are in the way to get out of the way. Every movement that has been successful has been led by young people. We should be supporting them, not critiquing them. Let's critique their own stuff 20 years later.
I want to pick up on what you were saying about love, because I think that is a really good segue to then promote our organization. I'm absolutely convinced that nothing is going to change in this country until white people get indignant on behalf of somebody they love. And the only way for us to get indignant on behalf of somebody we love is for us to be in relationship with people who are being oppressed, and to be in a store with our best friend and see them get passed over because they're black and I'm not. And to see that happen and say, wait, she was standing here. Or to have, one of my best friends, her name is Marquita, she goes by Alicia, because she didn't get job interviews. So, you know, to know that, and to be indignant on behalf of her, because I know that she is a brilliant woman who deserves better than that. And so our organization here, Neighbors United Undoing Racism, one of the main things that we do, we're not going to undo racism, but we're trying to find ways for people in this community, which is a largely white community, with people who don't look like me, and to find ways to, so we're trying to have picnics and Martin Luther King Day celebrations and panels like this and conversations, and it's about love, not that turns the other cheek, but it gets pissed off and stands up and says, no, this is not okay, this is somebody who deserves better, and it's not until we really love somebody who is being oppressed is that we really are going to be mad enough to do something about it. And so there's my plug, come join our organization. There's little bookmarks out there that talk about how you can get in touch with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
I just want to say I love hearing you guys talk, because it really opens me up, and I want to do this someday, you know, stand up here and motivate, even if it's not just like you. I want to motivate everybody to, you know, love themselves or even open themselves up to other people, because I feel like it's just the right thing to do. So thank y'all. Something to stop that agitation, you're going to have to find those organizations to get involved in. So, you know, I think this is a first step to me, because I imagine that some of you might have been uncomfortable with it. And I say, you know, keep going and don't be comfortable. That's what's going to make the change, keep going. And thank you all so much for listening to us.
I guess my closing remarks are just like, get angry, like be mad. I honestly be mad because that's the source. Like, just having anger is not enough, but it's enough to get you to start thinking about how to make decisions for yourself. And so, like, I really do, like, obviously, I fully embrace this idea of being an angry black man, and it is something that's going to keep me going until I create the systems that are necessary for my kids to be free, my actual kids, and then my students as well. Like, this world has to be different for my kids, period. And I'm saying my kids, but it affects you as well. And so I'm not saying, like, help black people out because we need your help. I'm saying, like, help black people out because it also affects you. Like, in a very real way, every single day that you wake up, it affects you. And so get angry that it affects you in a negative way. And if you really want to do something about it, like, get angry. Think about it, to your point, get angry. Think about something that you like and study it and write that shit down. And then start working towards it, period. That's it.